Well, if I can add my thanks to those of John to Cedar for the invitation and congratulate them on their timing. I think that this is a very good time to be discussing a subject which has perhaps been pushed into the background by a focus on the carbon issue, which is important as it is, could lead you to the impression that the main reason that we contemplate energy investments in this economy is to save CO2, rather than to supply an essential motor to the Australian economy and society. I don't say that overly critically, because it is an important issue and it did need to be addressed, but the pendulum does need to swing, and I perceive that it is beginning to, and I think that's, if anything, overdue. Now, I have a presentation. What you'll see in it is a series of quite abbreviated observations, and if you read them literally and don't listen to the words, you'll be misled in some particular cases. So, as a word of caution, please listen to the words. And can I also actually tell my own little anecdote? I did take the leap into the vertically integrated electricity monopoly as my first career move. And whereas John had the foresight to recognise the boredom factor before he took the move, I had to actually go through the experience to reach the same conclusion. And I say that with no disrespect to the industry, many of whose employees at the time are in this room. NEMCO, for example, sits down there. But at the time, it was an organisation overripe for substantial reform and reinvigoration, and that happened in my absence. Having come back into it, I too find electricity now exciting. And one might say that might just be a metaphor for ageing. I don't know. Be that as it may. One thing David Byers said in just preparing our thinking for this was that we need to get the focus on the broad security agenda and not simply on CO2. And indeed, as I've said, that's important. It's also important to recognise that even looking at energy security, CO2 sits, in my opinion, at the top of the list of security factors that need to be addressed, particularly in relation to electricity supply security. It broadly conceived, as John was indicating, as a matter of price, availability and affordability, not just the physical supply of the product. It's given the state's particular preoccupation, CO2 and carbon caps are a primary risk factor. I've listed a few others just to make it clear that it isn't just that, it's also climate change itself, and this is in no particular order. We've just been through, earlier this year, 3 days above 43 degrees in Melbourne, or in Victoria, which resulted in 3 days of load shedding of various dimensions in our state and in South Australia. We even had the interesting and somewhat disturbing phenomenon of an innocent little protection setting in a little station, part of the Basslink system in Launceston, which was set at 31 degrees, some protection setting. No, it was at 35, that's right. And it turned out that that was on the basis that it wasn't expected to ever reach that temperature in Launceston. And that, in fact, I think the previous maximum prior to the design of Basslink might have been 31, so there was a margin for error. It turned out, of course, that that was handsomely exceeded, and Basslink ran to zero, and that actually precipitated a loss of supply through the Victorian South Australian networks. The detail isn't important in the sense, what's important is to understand that in addition to carbon caps, climate change is a phenomenon that does affect the power supply security that we enjoy, and it has to be carefully weighed and dealt with. Leaping from the domestic to the global, I think that we are anticipating, I believe, a large global reinvestment task, all coincidental, all driven by a combination of growth in developing countries and CO2 concerns, coupled with growth in the Western economies, if you like, and that will intensify in this sector a competition not just for skills but also for finance, for equipment and other inputs, no doubt, which means that at the very time we're embarking upon the potential for a quite substantial rebuild, we're not alone, and that's going to have an impact, again, I would have thought, on our security, particularly our price security. We do have a gas market which has been insulated from global gas prices for a very long time by virtue of its size and lack of trading interconnection. That is generally agreed will change, and that will suddenly, over time, potentially have our gas prices fluctuating in the way that we have gradually become accustomed to our oil prices and petrol prices fluctuating. And that will in turn have an impact on the competitiveness of that particular commodity, and again a security consequence. I think globally there's an expectation of increasingly marginal fossil energy sources. I'd be getting out of my comfort zone to try and link that to any potential future price outcome, but I imagine that over time, again, you'll have a shift in competitiveness arising from that. And I could also add that while we have an intensive and quite impressive market supervision regulatory framework within Australia, there is no such analogue globally, and an increasingly globalised energy market, who knows what consequences might flow from that. And again, I'd be out of my comfort zone to speculate on that, but I'd be interested in hearing from those who know more about it, John Russell and others, on that particular point. So I can go to electricity security, where Victoria and me personally are probably in a more comfortable space to comment. I'm not going to go in great depth through these. I just wanted to point out that if the focus is on CO2, as it ought to be significantly when you are looking at a substantial transformation of your supply base, then here's some commentary on clean coal and on gas and on renewables and on nuclear and energy efficiency, which all add up to saying that we have many prospects for meeting the future constraints on CO2 that will emerge, none of which constitutes anything like the entire answer, all of which carry significant risks. I don't wish to be pessimistic about that because I don't think pessimism is warranted, but I would certainly suggest that we have, and this is John's point, a very large job to do in the transition and in the rebuild that follows the transition. I can come back to that if anyone's mildly interested later on. Now, what policy priorities might perhaps be relevant or embraced or even contemplated in order to deal with the challenges to power security, and particularly but not exclusively those presented by CO2 caps? I mentioned before, and I'll say again, a stable transition and a sound investment climate. Very critical. This is going to be a task, despite some commentary precipitated perhaps by the likes of Ross Garnaut, that will fall if Australia maintains its current policy settings to the private sector, to private capital, to private debt. And that is going to require careful management in such a game-changing world as we're about to enter, of the willingness of investors and of bankers and others to stay here and others to come in and ensure that the supply of capital, of quality capital and associated quality management, is up to what is going to be a large task. Now, I've listed 4 points there, some of which I would not want to have taken out of context, as to the ideal outcome for, as far as CPRS specifically is concerned, and associated reforms, in order to maintain or to provide for that transition and that climate. Early CPRS legislation is very important. Any failure to legislate, any inability to legislate, is going to maintain a high level of uncertainty until such time as what is generally perceived to be an inevitable carbon price is legislated. And that amounts to a lost opportunity for investment and a potential risk to security. There needs to be, between the time legislation and hence the shape of the scheme is clear, an adequate time to the start of trading. That is not, may I repeat, not a suggestion that a delay ought to be contemplated at the commencement of trading. This is, however, going to be necessarily something the Commonwealth Government will contemplate if it succeeds in legislating, but its negotiation period is a very long one, and significant uncertainty and a very short time to market start then ensues. There needs to be adequate transitional assistance. This is a point that has been made repeatedly in the public domain, and I would make it here. and that is particularly to ensure that we, and I'll repeat this, I'll make this point a little clearer on the last slide, that we maintain our reputation for investment and for quality capital, which we have assiduously, and particularly in Victoria, accumulated over the last 10 years. We have some quality energy companies here who are being publicly criticised as being the problem, who I would assert are significant parts, potential parts, of the solution. And indeed, the way they are treated will not only affect what they do, but what others who might contemplate being here with them or in their place might perceive as to being the risks in the Australian market. So that's a high-stakes game. Bill Scales headed a review under the COAG, auspices of COAG some time ago, which recommended privatisation of the electricity sector as an important context for a good investment climate. That, in my opinion, remains entirely correct. That's not been easy, and John Pearce bears the scars of attempting to advise on that point over the years. I think he's prepared to show them to you, if you ask nicely. But no one's allowed a photograph. Retail price deregulation is critical to ensuring that we don't add to the perceived risk of investing here, that there is the possibility of large investments being unrecoverable through the market, the operation of the market. I've put bipartisanship there. I've done that with some trepidation, given the size of the forum and the possible presence of the media, but I would make it quite clear that is not a lecture to the current federal government as to how it should prosecute its political strategy. It is simply to say that the right scheme enjoying bipartisan support is the ideal framework for investment going forward. It is simply the case that energy investments are too long-lived to enjoy the right level of sovereign risk if there is the chance of a scheme being substantially transformed on a change of government. That happens with industrial relations with frequency, as we know. The system does get overhauled virtually every time there's a change in political parties in Canberra. But I think that if you look at the length of EBAs and the consequence for investment in human resources, if I can put it in that language, that operates on a different timescale to the highly capital-intensive supply-side investments that we need for energy transformation. To go on from the transition to, well, how do we deal with this transformation, the word I keep using, there is a profound need for innovation on the supply side, and this is an unashamedly supply-side focused slide, simply because most of the gains in CO2 that will promote security are almost certainly going to be on the supply side. We already have in Victoria a substantial increase compared to, say, 5 years ago, in our co-funding of research and development of clean energy sources and our willingness to fund with quite large allocations relative to our budget the large-scale demonstration of energy sources that have a particular reason to be demonstrated here. There is going to be a debate, and this may well happen through the auspices of the white paper that John Pearce mentioned, on the need to have foundation public funding, co-funding, of the establishment of new power and CCS networks. That debate most often raises itself when people contemplate bringing power from the geothermal hot rock resources of South Australia around Moomba and the establishment of CCS networks, particularly between Outer Trobe Valley and the Bass Strait. It is going to be a debate that will go on, and it may well be that a case for some foundation public investment will be made, and particularly if the appetite to raise the carbon price to such a point as these would be remunerated without any public funding is going to be necessarily constrained by the capacity of the economy to deal with that price. Now, there's plenty of economic arguments as to why that might not be the way to go. That is to say, there'd be foundation public investment. That debate will occur, but I think that I would be betting that there will be a predisposition to head down that direction to some degree. Then there is the issue of accelerating investment. Once you have the sources, once you are looking to, in fact, build commercial plant, do we have the right settings for what is going to be, relatively speaking, a Herculean or at least a very large and challenging task? Do we have the environmental and planning approval regimes that will facilitate the flow of investment? Do we need stronger and more activist network planning? We have AEMO under construction as an entity. Is it going to have to be more directive in and more ambitious perhaps in its role in re-engineering networks to accommodate a new supply pattern? Do we need a stronger wholesale price signal in the electricity market? It's often unremarked that that a very large intervention occurred at the time the NEM was established to keep the cap on the spot price well below the apparent value that customers place on supply. That must have some impact on the extent to which investment comes forward. We've just been through this experience in Victoria of significant levels of load shedding on three consecutive days. It may well have been that some of the gas-fired plant that is on the drawing board now, had it been incentivised to be in the market a little earlier, a couple of years, 3 years earlier, it may well have been that not a single megawatt of load, or at least a far lower level of load, would have been lost at that time. Is that a price we would be prepared to pay? A higher level of the power price in our retail bills to have avoided that. The answer is not necessarily and inevitably, yes, we would have wanted to do that. But it's certainly an experience that was salutary enough for the government that I serve to want to ask that question, and it's now in the hands of the Australian Energy Market Commission to do so. Now, I believe I'm going to have to rush through the remainder of this. Yep. I won't dwell on the issue of transport energy security, but I will note that there are, and this is not, and this is an area that the state is considering its options in and its position on currently. Some observations there would be that, again, there are options for long-run security, and again, there are risks in there that need to be managed and dealt with in that transition. My own staff would want to constrain my enthusiasm to contemplate or to make the assertion that electric vehicles may well be a large part of the answer, simply because there is a reasonably clear path to zero emissions that I think is perhaps presenting itself more clearly than in the case of other vehicle technologies and supply sources. I did want to finish on a few observations about the CPRS. And the one that I would probably focus on most is that the CPRS is an ambitious and structurally sound scheme in its current design. You would think from the public commentary that wasn't true. I would argue that it is, and that indeed the transition that I've mentioned being such a large challenge, that's where additional risks may well still need to be managed by a review of some settings. I would also point to the last point on the slide there, that we have a public debate which is amongst the advocates looking for rapid action. Very rapid action, and that's understandable, but unfortunately the timescales of energy investment don't lend themselves to instant gratification. And so we have to have a public debate, which is difficult to do, which balances ambition and patience in equal measure. And one doesn't envy the task of our political masters to strike that balance. I thought I'd finish on a couple of notes of optimism. Here we have side views of a coal-fired power station, the top one being a subcritical boiler using brown coal, current best technology, the bottom one being integrated dry and gasification combined cycle, which will be eminently compatible with CCS, and you can see just in the physical dimensions of that why there is the prospect to in fact have your cake and eat it, have a significantly cheaper supply source, leaving aside the CO2 price, the CCS price, at the same time as a higher efficiency transformation of brown coal. And here we have, and that by the way has state funding, the IDGCC project has grant funding for large scale demonstration, as does this facility, which is a pilot plant for large scale photovoltaic technology that is pioneered in Victoria by Solar Systems. This is the pilot plant at Bridgewater near Bendigo, so-called On Sun. which is the precursor to a full-scale plant planned for the north of the state. And that is enough from me, and I apologise for running out of time.